Well, don't forget them. As surgeon in charge here, that's the thing I want to stress. This is the sixth Christmas the boys have celebrated since the war began, and it won't be the last one. They come from all over the world, and they keep on coming. To many of them, it's as near home as they have known for a long time. Yes, the war's over for most people, but not quite yet for these lads. And the job we've got to do is to make them feel that they're back on the map spiritually, although they mayn't be physically. Well, I know that I'm voicing the general feeling here when I send to all our friends our best wishes for their happiness. In particular, to all guinea pigs scattered over the world in 17 different countries. We here in Ward 3 at East Grinstead say to them all, thumbs up and a Merry Christmas. All right, we'll sing our own anthem. Wait till I get to the piano now.
Yes, the boys are gathering around the piano now. They're the men who had the worst of this war. Boys shot down in the Battle of Britain. Bomber pilots, tank crew. Many of them are scarred for life. Some of them crippled. But they're not letting it worry them today anyway. They're going to sing their own anthem now with their own surgeon playing the piano. We are Mackindo's army. We are his guinea pigs.
It is Christmas 1945. After 6 long years, the Second World War is finally over. But for the men we just heard singing their carol, a new battle had begun. To recover from the horrific injuries they had sustained in the conflict. These men, in many cases just 19 or 20 when they signed up to fight, had known they were at great risk of injury, even death. But they hadn't known, indeed couldn't know, that they were to sustain injuries that had never been survived before. You might be surprised. Listening to them singing around the piano, they sound like they haven't a care in the world. That certainly wasn't the case, but thanks to the incredible pioneering work of their surgeon and their own efforts to provide lifelong mutual support to one another, they went on to live long, happy, and successful lives. Those men were the Guinea Pig Club, and this is their story. Welcome to All Stations, the podcast from the Royal Air Force Benevolent Fund. I'm Victoria Taylor, a military historian specialising in British and German aviation. Last series, we heard voices from the Battle of Britain, telling the stories of those who defended the country from Nazi invasion. This time, in a three-part special mini-series, we're celebrating the lives and achievements of one group of remarkable men who suffered horrific burns injuries fighting in the Second World War and who were all treated at East Grinstead Hospital. We'll explore the story of the pioneering medicine that saved their lives and how that legacy lives on today. ...2021 marks 80 years since the Guinea Pig Club was formed by a handful of men with a bottle of sherry on a hospital ward. Thanks to the oral history archive at the Imperial War Museum, we are able to hear many of them tell their own stories. Thomas Gleave was a fighter pilot in the Battle of Britain. He was shot down in the summer of 1940.
My own aircraft burst into flames. I attempted to localise the fire and skidding and at the same time losing speed, but the fire increased. And I tried to get out, but unable to move owing to burns. The aircraft blew up and I was blown clear. That's why I'm still here.
George Bennions had joined the RAF before the war and became a leading Spitfire ace. He'd been awarded the Distinguished Flying Cross on the morning his crash happened.
I was suddenly hit on the left-hand side with a cannon shell, and it exploded in the cockpit and blinded me in my left eye and severed the median nerve in my right arm and damaged my right leg. and generally made a bit of a mess, but I managed to get the oxygen undone. And then I thought, how am I going to get out of this aeroplane? I thought, I can't climb out, I can't use my right leg. So I thought the best thing to do was to open the side door and roll out. So I opened the side door with my left hand and then rolled the aircraft over to the left and fell out.
Geoffrey Page was shot down over the Channel during the Battle of Britain. The intensity of the fire was something he'd never forget.
Suddenly there was an enormous bang, and then the whole aircraft just exploded. The scientists reckon the temperature goes up from a cool room temperature at 15,000 feet to 3,000 degrees centigrade in about 10 seconds. So when you consider water boils at 100 degrees centigrade, you've got quite a temperature change there on your hands. But stupidly, I wasn't wearing any gloves. And later on, it became mandatory to wear gloves. My hands got a terrible burning, and face as well. My mouth and nose were saved by my oxygen mask.
The battle in the skies during the Second World War brought huge changes in technology. New planes, new weapons, and ever more powerful fuel. But it also meant new injuries. Injuries that a person wasn't expected to survive. But these men did, and their wounds would test the boundaries of modern medicine and human endurance. Between 1939 and 1945, 4,500 Allied crewmen were rescued with burn injuries. More than 80% of them had what became known as airman's burns, a deep tissue burn to their hands or face. Dr. Emily Mayhew is a military medical historian at Imperial College London, who has written a book about the Guinea Pig Club.
So when the fire rushes over them, these sort of these flare-ups of fire, they do the worst damage to the flesh that is exposed. And in the case, and you didn't really need very much to prevent real damage being done. You just needed a layer of RAF tunic and perhaps an undershirt. But if your face and your hands were exposed, which they almost always were, particularly during the Battle of Britain, because the weather was very good and people found it hot and sweaty to wear gloves and goggles, then that was the flesh that was damaged by the fire.
At the start of the war, patients with burns injuries had a long and painful road ahead of them. The standard treatment involved a hardening agent called tannic acid, which would be applied, wrapped in bandages, and then later unwrapped to reveal a tough layer of scar tissue. Thomas Gleave, who would go on to become chief guinea pig, was given this treatment before he was transferred to East Grinstead. He remembered it with horror.
We'd all gone to other hospitals where they'd done their best, but the tannic acid and so on was absolute hell. Then they came to East Grinstead and find all those nightmares vanished overnight. I used to hate the morning. I used to hate the dawn. I knew this had been another tug on these bloody bandages, you know. And when the chaps got there, all that vanished out the window.
There had to be another way. And there was. The Queen Victoria Hospital in East Grinstead had been a cottage hospital, but a specialist burns unit was set up there at the start of the war. It was run by Sir Archibald Mackindoe, a pioneering surgeon from New Zealand specialising in the relatively new field of plastic surgery. Whereas other hospitals treated patients using established techniques, Mackindoe's specialist burns unit could be very innovative. Ian Anderson suffered serious nose injuries after his Wellington bomber crashed in a training sortie over the Isle of Man in 1943. In 1944, he was being treated at Ely Hospital when Mackindoe offered him a place in his ward at the Queen Victoria Hospital.
I was sitting in this queue of patients waiting to go in and see the ENT specialist. And this character came in a loud check suit with heavy horn-rimmed spectacles. Looked rather like a bookie, actually. And asked me what had happened. And so I told him, I gave him the history of this. And he said, well, I'm McIndoe. He said, I operate at East Grinstead. He said, would you like to come down to East Grinstead? So I said, not R. So he said, well, I'll tell you what to do. He said, get me a full frontal photograph of what you were like previously and, if possible, two in profile and send them down. He said, and I'll arrange it.
One of the greatest changes McIndoe made was as a result of observing his patients. He noticed that the men who had crashed into the channel were healing considerably better than those who hadn't. The oldest cure in the book, salt water, was working its magic. Unable to take the men to the sea, McIndoe found a new way to bring the sea to the men. Thomas Gleave again.
And so I was carried over in the corner of this ward, behind some curtains. They had the sort of bath you see lying outside a demolished house, you know, thing on four legs, with bits of pipe on it. Well, Archie McIndoe had had one of these brought into the ward, and the pipes, the hot water pipe, went through a little instrument, which rang a bell if the temperature went half a degree higher or lower than blood temperature. And there's something else there, and another a bell or a light came on. And this is the salt bath in which you were put. This is the one that became the very famous burned salt bath. And I was taken there in the afternoon, outwardly a picture of fantastic courage, and inwardly scared stiff. Being a squadron leader in the ward, I had to look very brave. And I was put in this salt bath. And the effect was so fantastic, I nearly passed out. It was unbelievable. Don't forget, you've got raw flesh everywhere, no skin. Raw flesh, your hands got no skin at all, hardly. And your face, I had big patches on my face. You just feel fine, it's unbelievable to go in. But the great thing about it was it heals skin. And I got so fond of this bath every day. They used to put me in just before lunch. I had a thing across the bath, and I could turn the pages with my little fingers. And I used to read a book. Lying in the bath. It was every day for weeks.
McIndoe's salt baths were a new application of an age-old treatment. But his surgical techniques were even more innovative. Along with his team, he set about rebuilding his patients' noses, hands and ears using brand new methods, such as the tube pedicle graft. Dr. Emily Mayhew explains.
Archibald McIndoe never loses this sense of experimentation. He always realises that he's the pioneer, but also he's becoming the expert in the field. So if the choices that he makes about how he repairs people, how he repairs the guinea pigs, are going to be the choices that stand for other surgeons in the future. So he's really careful about what he does. He has techniques that we would recognise today, which is an ordinary skin graft, where you take skin from a donor area, say somewhere like your back or your shoulders, and you move it onto the hand or a burn on the arm or on the face. But when a whole area on the face had gone, that kind of repair would take a very long time. So he uses a technique, he masters a technique that we used right up until the 1980s called the tube pedicle graft. And it was where he took a slice of soft tissue, usually from somewhere on the arm, protected by the RAF tunic. And he takes it, if you think about it as an envelope-shaped piece of soft tissue, he takes it up on three sides and he leaves one side down and it connects the blood supply. And he gradually folds that over, opens up a small wound on the higher up on the arm and folds that in and moves the tissue with the blood supply further and further up. And when it gets to the face, that means it can repair a whole nose or a whole lip or a whole chin in one go.
Emily Mayhew says it's hard to overstate the significance of McIndoe's work.
When I do historical analysis, we're not really supposed to say it's one person who comes along on one day and makes a difference. But in the case of the Guinea Pig Club, it was. There was originally he was an abdominal surgeon from New Zealand. And actually, that's a good point, because when you have to do abdominal surgery, you have to be very good at very fine kinds of repair. We don't really know a great deal about him as a man because he didn't write down very much. He didn't talk about his work very much. He mostly just did his work. And in 1938, when the very first patient arrives who's been burned in training, He sees the problems that he's had with his face and that his eyelids have been very badly burned. And there's nothing in the textbooks that tells you how to fix eyelids, except that you know you need to fix them, because if you don't, that person will lose their sight. And one of the very few things he ever did say was, "I looked at the burned boy with his burned eyelids and God came down my right arm." And he relied on his surgical instincts and the techniques he'd learned in abdominal surgery, and he resolved the problem with the eyelids.
Mackindoe's surgical developments were life-changing for his hundreds of patients, and many more, as others adopted his techniques. But I'm only just getting to the most remarkable thing about the medical staff and patients in East Grinstead. Mackindoe understood that recovery must not only be physical. These young men, some only teenagers, had suffered injuries that people had never experienced before, injuries they weren't expected to survive. That could feel devastating. Ian Anderson and George Benyons recall the difficulty that came with facial injury.
You could imagine the reactions of young aircrew, for instance, who had been badly burned, got into East Grinstead. I think it was one of the biggest battles that Mackindoe had to combat. You know, you'd probably have a lad of about 20 or 21 in a fairly glamorous aircrew occupation, not finding it difficult to attract the girls, and then suddenly, within a matter of a minute, he probably finds himself looking like a monster.
First few weeks, I don't remember much about it, really. I was very concerned, very upset, feeling rather annoyed with myself for having been shot down so decisively. And I felt, I don't know how, awful feeling really, terribly isolated. I couldn't see, I couldn't hear very well. I couldn't recognise people unless it was somebody very close to me. I felt so deflated, just as though half my life had been taken and the other half wasn't worth bothering with. It was, I think, the worst period of my life.
To make matters worse, these injuries looked shocking to people who didn't know what to expect. At the start of the war, in some cases, even the men's own families reacted negatively to seeing them for the first time.
They would go in, see a member of the guinea pig club whose face had gone, and they would scream and leave the room. And you can imagine the impact that that was going to have on someone's recovery, someone's well-being.
And so Mackindoe set about making East Grinstead a place where the young men would not feel that they had become monstrous. He deliberately chose experienced and attractive nurses who wouldn't flinch at the sight of disfiguring burns. One of those nurses was Emily Mayhew's own grandmother.
My grandmother was brought in because she was a little bit older. She didn't have particularly technical nursing training. She was from the voluntary aid detachment. But what she could do was handle anything that this injury and this patient group would throw at her.
Next, Mackindoe spoke to the local community, asking them to treat the men as normal, to become the town that didn't stare. It's a label East Grinstead has worn with pride ever since. Ian Anderson explains.
One of the ways he approached it was that he approached the whole population of East Grinstead and explained the problem to them. And so the whole of the population of East Grinstead, I suppose, in those days cooperated, and they accepted the guinea pigs as perfectly normal human beings. So if you went to a dance, for instance, the girls might come up and ask you for a dance. And I think this worked wonders, you know.
The men also found solace in being around each other, their shared experience helping them to feel less isolated. George Benyons explained the impact that had for him.
The people in the hospital put me on a much more even footing. And my friend, the chap I joined up with from school, was in Ward 3 at his granddad. He'd been shot down flying a Hurricane. And he was in Ward 3, and he'd heard that I'd been admitted to the hospital, and he'd sent a message along, could I go and see him, because he couldn't get out of bed, his legs were badly burnt. But would I go and see him? Well, I was on crutches at the time, but I managed to get over there with a hell of a lot of struggle and self-pity. And as I opened the door in Ward 3, I saw what I can only describe now as the most horrifying thing that I've ever seen in my life. And that was this chap who'd been badly burnt, really badly burnt. His hair was burned off, his eyebrows were burnt off, his eyelids were burnt off, you could just see staring eyes. His nose was burnt, there were just two holes in his face. His lips were badly burnt. And then when I looked down, his hands were burnt. And I looked down at his feet on the little trail, and his feet were burnt. And I got through the door on the crutches with a bit of a struggle. And this chap started propelling a wheelchair down the ward. And halfway down, he picked up a chair with his teeth. And that's when I noticed how badly his lips were burnt. And then he brought this chair down the ward and threw it alongside. And he said, "Have a seat, old boy." And I cried. And I thought, what have I to complain about? And from then on, everything fell into place.
By the way, the friend George Benyons is talking about there, Ralph Carnell, went on to recover and return to operational flying during the war. Mackindoe's approach meant that rather than the men feeling miserable about being stuck in hospital, they began to enjoy their time there. You only have to listen to his patients like Thomas Gleave and Ian Anderson to hear how his cheerful nature affected them.
The confidence Archie imbued into people was part of the healing. He kept the morale right at the very top. He left him on.
His manner was completely outgoing. He was a complete optimist, tremendous personality, and always hopeful of success. And he was able to instill this into his patients, you see.
Having created such a supportive environment, Sir Archibald Mackindoe had gifted the young men with the chance to have some control over their own healing and recovery. And they started putting their own support system in place too. Each other. The roots for the Guinea Pig Club were there, but the story of how the club was actually founded is almost the stuff of legend. Thomas Gleave, George Benyons, and Geoffrey Page pick up the tale.
In 1941, we formed a club, and because we'd all had, most of us had innovations in plastic surgery due to Archie Mackindoe's genius. And one night, two people in bed were discussing their progress through the hospital while the rest of us were drinking beer in East Kingston. They came to the conclusion they were guinea pigs. And so the name stuck. And not long afterwards, one Sunday lunchtime, when the surgeons came over and those of us who could walk went into their bar and had drinks with them, we decided to form a club.
I think the major objective at the time was they were trying to have an excuse for having a club so they could import beer and wine into the Ward 3 so they could have a drink in the hospital, because it was about that time that they started introducing, you know, a barrel of beer into the ward and a piano into a ward and things that had been unheard of up to then.
But a group of us who were fighter pilots, we got together and formed a little club which we call the Guinea Pig Club, and from the six of us who started it, there have been about 700 went through that hospital and became members of the Guinea Pig Club.
as Geoffrey Page just said, what started as a social and drinking club meant to last only for the duration of the war went on to become an organisation that has provided unwavering support to almost 700 men and their families for 80 years. Over the years, it evolved to have annual get-togethers with families too. And later, as the men aged, the club helped make life a little easier day to day. The criteria to join was simple. One had to be an Allied crewman who had undergone at least two operations at the Queen Victoria Hospital for burns or other crash-related injuries. One of those men was Jack Perry. Jack was just 19 when his Halifax bomber exploded during a training exercise in 1944. He suffered extensive burns to his hands, ears, and face, and underwent 30 operations in total, 12 of which were at East Grinstead. The youngest member of the club, he went on to serve as social secretary, bringing the men together at multiple events and functions until his death, aged 92, in 2017. Jack's son, Andrew Perry, stood proudly beside his father at many of the later guinea pig events. I met up with him to ask about the importance of the club to his dad's life. Andrew started by telling me how he first realised how extraordinary his father's experience was.
When I was young, I didn't really realise what had actually happened. And I did an RAF blog some time ago. And out of that, I suddenly realised that when I was quite young, I picked a book up off the bookshelf and these pictures fell out of when Dad was first burnt. And yeah, it just suddenly kind of hit me because we had a lot of guinea pig friends, people that used to come to the house. And it was almost quite normal, you know, that people, you know, Dad's had, because it was basically his hands and his ears. It just made me sort of realise that something had actually happened to him. And I think that's a real stark realisation that when that happens, you just suddenly think, oh, okay, yeah, he's actually been through some stuff. So that was really the sort of first time, I suppose.
And what about his guinea pig friends that were visiting your house? You know, how did you respond to them as a child? Because, of course, you are accustomed to, you know, certain aspects of your dad's appearance. And, of course, yeah. You would have become accustomed to them. But what were your impressions of them?
Well, Dad really was quite mild compared to lots of them. Some of them were incredibly badly burnt. But again, they had that ability to sort of welcome people, to sort of draw people in, talk about it. If they looked at them, they would be, they would just deal with it. It was like, have a beer, less of a beer, less of a chat about it. There's one particular story where Dad had organised one of his events, and there was a chap called Les Wilkins, who was one of Dad's closest friends. And this guy was a pig farmer in Swindon. Incredibly badly burnt. He literally had fists for hands, a little bit hanging off and whatever. And Dad had organised one of his guinea pig events, and they're in the local pub in our village in Oxfordshire. And basically this guy Les went to the loo, and he was standing there with four other guys, and he sort of walked in incredibly badly burnt. So all these guys were a bit like, oh my God, really sort of quite sort of nervy. Basically, he couldn't, like a normal guy, do what needs to be done. So he had a little loop on there and whatever. And these guys were all looking very awkward and, probably couldn't do what they were planning to do when they walked in there. And basically what happened, Les passed wind and just turned around and looked at everybody. And everybody was sort of like, this guy's incredibly badly burnt. We're trying not to look at him fumbling around, blah, 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 blah. And then he does this. And apparently he just turned around and said, is anybody hurt? Which I think just identifies, that to me personifies the guinea pig humour. It's that incredibly stupid sort of black humour. And of course, 15 minutes later, he's with all these guys in the bar having a drink and they're his best mates, But I think it's getting a bit deep here. I think people look at people and think, oh my God, this is awful. You've been through this. You must be some kind of monster. You must be whatever. And in fact, these people are just regular people who happen to look a bit different. And it's really as simple as that. But the fact they look a bit different makes them incredibly strong, great resolve, and also great compassion for other people.
You know, McIndoe sort of places that equal value on making sure that men, the men of the Guinea Pig Club, are given mental and almost holistic support as well as physical treatment. And what difference do you think that made in terms of their long-term recovery and their outlook on life?
Massive.
Yeah.
Huge. You know, I think it's really easily explained, isn't it? If you've got a positive attitude about a problem, you're going to deal with it massively better. So he just gave them the sort of the mental tools, I suppose would be a good term for it, to actually be able to deal with this stuff and sort of face it full on, which I think is a huge part of life, really, isn't it? You know, it really gets down to the true part of the story, which I'm quite passionate about, which is the psychological side of it and the fact that the Guinea Pig Club sort of was a vehicle for it, really, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. You know, to be able to have that sense of humour and that, you know, everything about them was naughty, basically, you know, but it kind of worked, so yeah.
And of course, you know, I mean, you've got that sort of camaraderie amongst the men themselves, you know, they're supporting each other in terms of, you know, trying to get to their goals, trying to rehabilitate, sort of coping with the gallows humour amongst the way, but also, you know, what about the other people working at the hospital? So we often mention the surgeons, but, you know, the nurses, the support staff, you know, what difference did their actions make to the men?
I just think they were a team. They're just an incredible team, you know, who worked as a team. And I think, you know, there's a couple of guys I know that actually work with McIndoe. And, you know, he was apparently a very hard man, a very fair man, but really, really hard. So he had a standard, and if you were part of his team. But my understanding of it was literally everybody was absolutely wonderful. And I've met nurses from that time, I've met technicians from that time. And they're just all amazing people. There's this bond, you know, and I think, I don't know if they realised at the time the sort of history that they're actually making, but they really were.
So moving into that unique guinea pig identity, your dad went on to become the social secretary of the club for 40 years. How important was the camaraderie of the group for him and for his well-being?
Massively, massively. He just kept it going, you know, because obviously this is, you know, he was young for the club. He just, you know, he would organise regular events. There'd be like a Christmas lunch. There would be, you know, they used to do trips to Czechoslovakia and various other places. And he just organised all these events and just loved it. That really, I think that just kept him going. He just loved it. He just loved that whole thing. There was always, whenever the guinea pigs met, and people that weren't really aware of the club would say, come to a dinner or whatever. And you just see the affection of these guys.
And what are your memories of the Guinea Pig Club reunions and social events that he helped to organise?
Just really good fun. A bunch of people that really cared about each other, had a common thread, and anything would happen. You know, Dad was amazing at getting stuff out of people. So suddenly there'd be a trip to Williams Car Factory or some brewery, Shepherd Neem, who got very, very involved with the club. And he's had that ability to sort of get people on his side, and suddenly they're organising a lunch, probably paying for the lunch and whatever. And then the guinea pigs just turn up and get treated like, you know, whatever. But yeah, it was probably a new lease of life for him. And then I got mixed up in it as well. And it's great fun. I loved it. Loved it. It's brilliant.
What's the importance of the Royal Air Force Benevolent Fund support?
Oh, massive. So the Benevolent Fund to me, it's been massive. So I went to an RAF Benevolent Fund school. So that was my first real sort of taste of it, of the RAF family. But all the way through Mum and Dad's latter life, they were just incredibly supportive. You know the various controllers, and you know, we got to know them all really well. They would attend guinea pig functions, and they were just brilliant to the guinea pigs. You know, they've supported them financially, you know, on every level. It's been amazing. So yeah, really great people, really great organization.
Can you express what your dad's life might have been like without the Guinea Pig Club? Did he, for example, ever express how difficult things had been before the formation of the club when he began his treatment?
That's a really good question. I think he's never actually spoken about it specifically, but I think looking at what the club has done for him as a support network, his life would have been much harder, much more difficult. A lot of doors were opened, I think, being a member of the club. So not only was there the support and camaraderie, but people just helped out. People would do things, you know. I think what it did, it allowed a lot of people who had a lot of hardship and a lot of stuff put in their way, it allowed them to sort of jump over that and just live better lives, you know.
In terms of speaking about what is sort of unique about the Guinea Pig Club, obviously your dad worked tirelessly to raise the profile of the Guinea Pig Club and make sure that all of its veterans felt connected to each other and they felt heard and supported. What do you think your dad would have liked people to remember the most about the Guinea Pig Club specifically?
I think to keep the story going, to keep the story and that spirit of life can chuck some awful stuff at you, but you can still bounce back. That's probably it, really. You know, the fact that it can look pretty bleak, and a lot of these guys, you know, they're obviously very physically damaged, but visually. And so suddenly, you know, 19-year-old guy, probably a pretty good-looking bloke, suddenly loses half his face. You know, that's pretty serious. So I suppose it's just really the fact that you can get over things, you can deal with things. So that's probably it, really, I think. Just that positive story, you know. And that life is to be enjoyed, you know, just make sure you enjoy it. So, yeah. Mm.
And if you had to share one thing that you learnt personally from your dad as the child of a guinea pig, what would it be?
Probably just to be incredibly positive, just to never give up, just stick with what you believe, just do what you feel, and nothing's going to pull you down. You know, that was dad's general ethos in life. So I try and follow the same.
Jack Perry's determined attitude to life was certainly shared by his fellow guinea pigs. The men went on to lead fulfilled and distinguished lives, going on to work as Fleet Street journalists, head teachers, and even, in some cases, returning to active service. The Guinea Pig Club, initially designed only to last the war, united the men throughout their lives, supported by the Royal Air Force Benevolent Fund. In this rare recording from 1958, Sir Archibald Mackindoe himself explained its vital importance.
It's a reunion in one way, but in another sense it has a very special purpose behind it. You see, it embraces practically all the seriously disfigured and injured pilots of the last war. These men have required very careful handling, very careful rehabilitation to get them back to a normal way of life. To keep them together is the secret of success. It's done by a variety of methods. Mainly it's been done by help which has been given to us by the public, and in particular through the RAF Benevolent Fund, which has spent many thousands of pounds on the rehabilitation of these young men.
Sir Archibald Mackindoe died in 1960. But in the years following the war, he had served as the Guinea Pig Club's president before His Royal Highness the Duke of Edinburgh took on the role, and was knighted for his services to surgery and rehabilitation. In 2014, a sculpture of Mackindoe was erected at the Queen Victoria Hospital, with several surviving guinea pigs there to pay tribute to the man who saved their lives. The artist, Martin Jennings, was the son of another of Mackindoe's patients. The legacy of Mackindoe and the Guinea Pig Club goes beyond their own lives and experiences. In the next episode, we'll be exploring a similar club formed after modern conflicts, the Kazifak Club. Like the guinea pigs, Kazifak is a group of just under 700 servicemen and women who have experienced injuries that they simply weren't expected to survive. Actor Fiona Dolman and writer Jed Mercurio will be hearing from a member of the club and a crewman who helped them get to safety. This podcast has been brought to you by the Royal Air Force Benevolent Fund, the Royal Air Force's charity supporting those who are serving or have served in the Royal Air Force and their families when they need it most. We provide the financial, emotional, and practical support that helps people live with the dignity and independence they deserve. We rely on the generous donations of people like you to ensure that we can continue to be here for as long as they need us. If you'd like to find out more about the Guinea Pig Club and how the fund supports members of the Guinea Pig Club, or to donate, please check out our website, refbf.org. This series is a Chalk and Blade production, brought to you by the Royal Air Force Benevolent Fund. This episode was presented by me, Victoria Taylor. The producer is Rosie Stopher, the mix and theme music are by Alex Port-Felix, and the executive producers are Laura Sheeter and Fiona Ferguson. The oral history clips of the Guinea Pig Club members are courtesy of the Imperial War Museum. The archive clips of Sir Archibald MacIndoe are courtesy of the BBC and ICN. A special thank you to our contributors, Dr. Emily Mayhew and Andrew Perry.